About 120 new diagnoses are made every year identifying Iowans who are HIV positive. The Iowa Department of Public Health wants every Iowan to get tested for HIV. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer. Today, what advancements have been made in prevention and treatment of HIV and AIDS? What risks remain? How is testing done? And what might have changed about what people see as a stigma associated with having HIV? Also, hear the details of the case of an Iowan who was sentenced to 25 years in prison for exposing a sexual partner to HIV. Join the conversation after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. December 1st was World AIDS Day. The goal of that annual event is to unite people worldwide in the fight against HIV and to commemorate those who have died from acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. HIV is human immunodeficiency virus. That's an infection that causes AIDS. The Iowa Department of Public Health wants all Iowans to get tested for the virus. Later in the hour, we'll talk with public health officials and a medical doctor who specializes in infectious disease. We'll also be joined by an Iowan that has HIV. But first, Sergio Hernandez is a freelance journalist for ProPublica. His article, Sex, Lies, and HIV, When What You Don't Tell Your Partner Is a Crime, was published on Sunday. That's an in-depth look at a case of an Iowa man who's charged with having sex without first disclosing he had HIV. Sergio Hernandez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
I'm glad to have you on the program. Well, this case centers on Nick Rhodes, an Iowan that has HIV and had apparently had sexual relations with another man, used a condom, did not transmit the virus, but did not tell his partner that he had the virus. And he was later arrested, convicted, given a 25-year prison sentence. The case is currently in the appeals process. But what does the law say that we're speaking about?
Well, so Iowa has this law called the Criminal Transmission of HIV Law, which, you know, despite how it sounds, it actually doesn't require anyone to become infected or for HIV to be transmitted. It basically just bans, you know, the exposure of somebody to another person in a way in which HIV could be transmitted. And it's got kind of this sort of funny, sort of ambiguously worded language, which is sort of at the heart of the appeal in the Nick Rhodes case now, whether or not what happened during his encounter with this other man actually exposed him to HIV.
And so why don't we discuss what actually happened in this case?
So Nick Rhodes, back in 2008, he met another man, Adam Plundle, who's a University of Iowa student in Cedar Falls, and they had a sexual encounter. And then, you know, a couple of nights later, Adam Plundle was having a cigarette with a mutual friend who told him that Nick Rhodes was HIV positive. Adam Plundle, you know, went to the hospital to try and get a prescription of HIV drugs, of a regimen of HIV drugs that if you take within 72 hours of exposure to the virus can actually stop the infection from taking root in your cells. He gets to the hospital, and the ER nurse, I guess, interpreted this as kind of a sexual assault case and called the local police. The police officers showed up. They interviewed Adam Plundle, and then the case sort of took on its own life from there. They obtained Nick's medical records, confirmed that he had been HIV positive, arrested him, and charged him under this criminal transmission of HIV law.
And it's not as though Plundle was seeking charges. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, Plundle says that he never intended to press charges, that he just went to the hospital to try and get a prescription for this post-exposure treatment. And it wasn't until the hospital called the police that it kind of occurred to him that he was the victim of a crime. And, you know, from that point on, he did cooperate with the police. He set up his phone with some recording equipment at the police station to record a phone call with Nick. He gave a statement at Nick's sentencing hearing asking for the full sentence. So he did cooperate with the police, and he did, you know, sort of participate in the prosecution. But the way he says that he never originally intended to press charges. It wasn't his idea.
And so what happened? How did the case unfold? Nick Rhodes was arrested. What was he charged with?
So he was arrested, and he was charged with criminal transmission of HIV. And he ended up sitting in the Black Hawk County Jail for about a year before pleading guilty, hoping that he would get a lenient sentence. The judge instead actually gave him the maximum sentence, which was 25 years in state prison, and he ended up going to state prison for about 9 months before he applied for a sentence reconsideration, which the judge later granted and reduced his 25-year prison sentence to 5 years of probation. But in addition to the probation term, he's also now registered as a sex offender for the rest of his life, which means, you know, he can't be around children or minors under the age of 14, including his own family. He has to wear a GPS ankle bracelet. He can't vote. He can't use Facebook or Twitter. He can't drink alcohol. He has a curfew. He has to be home at like 11 or midnight every night. So there's, you know, a lot of restrictions that still go along with the probation and the sex offender registration.
Well, and going back to the law itself, what we tend to refer to as a HIV transmission law, but no transmission took place here. So what is the law actually applying here?
Right. So the law is a bit of a misnomer. Verbatim, the law bans basically the intentional exposure of the body of one person to the bodily fluids of another person in a manner in which HIV could be transmitted. So one of the tricky things in the appeal is whether or not, is what kind of intent this law actually requires, whether it requires somebody to intend to transmit or expose someone to HIV. That's what Nick Rhodes' lawyers argue. The state kind of argues that actually it's just the intent to have sex, that anyone who is HIV positive who has sex without disclosing their status would be vulnerable to prosecution under this law.
This law is not unique to Iowa. There are other states with similar, in fact, quite similar, maybe exactly the same. how is that?
Yeah, so there are at least 35 states who have laws on the books that are essentially the same and that they criminalize exposure to HIV or non-disclosure of one's HIV status. But there are a handful of other states that actually have nearly identical laws to Iowa's because they actually originated from this group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is sort of a coalition of conservative lawmakers and sort of big business groups that get together every year and they have a big conference and they draft model legislation that their members then take back to their states and try to pass in their local legislature. Legislatures. And so in the 80s, they put together a task force to sort of address HIV and AIDS issues, legal issues with legislation. So they put together this task force, and one of the sort of model prototype bills that came out of it was this thing called the HIV Assault Act. And then, you know, it kind of trickled down to the different states, and several states passed various versions of this law. Iowa passed its law in 1998, but you know other states like Michigan and Tennessee actually have versions of the law that are almost identical.
And so so in Iowa the law was enacted in the late 90s, I believe.
Right. I think it was enacted in 98, but it was actually introduced in Iowa, I think, like in 93. You know, by 1993 it had already been introduced, but it hadn't been enacted until 1998.
Well, one part of your article included the statistic that a ProPublica analysis had gathered that over the last decade there have been at least 541 cases in which people were convicted or pled guilty to or criminal charges for not disclosing they were HIV positive. It was info from that information. How many states was that?
So we looked at data from 19 different states. It was states where we were able to get kind of some as comprehensive data as we could get. And it was sort of gathered from court records, from police reports, from, databases of sex offenders and prison inmates. And so we mined all of that to try and find, you know, how many convictions there have been under these laws and to some extent how many prosecutions and arrests there have been under these laws. So total, we gathered something like 1,400 cases since 2003. Some of those could be, you know, duplicates. So we kind of narrowed that down to convictions, and we found about 541 convictions across 19 states since 2003.
And other cases in Iowa?
Oh, yeah. Iowa has had, I think, like 25 convictions since the law was enacted. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a man, Donald Bogardis, who was on trial for the same thing, and he just pleaded guilty to that. And I think I'm told that he like holds the record for the longest pre-trial waiting period before actually going to trial. And that was actually the same county. It was also Black Hawk County.
Well, in the Nick Rhodes case, it was a sexual act was part of the reasoning for the conviction. Other ways of transmitting HIV, though, do we? How common are other ways of transmitting HIV to this?
So some of the laws, including Iowa's, also criminalize, sharing needles with somebody for intravenous drug use and not disclosing that you're HIV positive. Some of the laws also make it illegal to spit on or bite or scratch, for instance, a police officer. So for in Nebraska, for instance, spitting or biting a police officer is a misdemeanor and it can get you, a small fine. But if you're HIV positive and that same crime is like a $10,000 fine and 5 years in prison and it's a felony, even though spitting and scratching, the CDC says that cannot transmit HIV. There are enzymes in saliva, for instance, that kill the virus. You can't get it from scratching. So some of the laws actually make it illegal, criminalize certain behaviors that are not medically recognized as transmission routes for HIV.
I want to quickly go to a caller. Let's go to Dan in Des Moines.
Oh, sure.
Dan, go ahead.
Hi. See, I'd just like to point out that when you were talking about this guy being reticent about charging this guy, if he were reticent about it, when he went in for that test or that treatment, he could easily have said he knew the guy had HIV and there would not have been a case. So I find it kind of disheartening that you're soft selling his part, his role in this accusation.
Okay.
You mean Adam Plendel, the accuser's role?
Yeah, the accuser could easily have gone in and got the
absolutely.
Drug and said, I knew he had AIDS, and he would not have been charged.
Yeah, and that's one of the criticisms that people have of these laws is that in a lot of cases it can very much be sort of a he said, she said situation where, it could be a relationship that went south or something and you have kind of this spurned ex or partner or something who could easily just on the one hand say that they didn't know that the person was HIV positive, even though maybe they did.
Well, Sergio Hernandez, I know you have to go in just a minute. And thank you for the call, Dan, from Des Moines. Appreciate that. What do we know about there's been pushes in past years for change to this law? What do we know about efforts to either refine or change the law in Iowa?
Yeah, so there is a bill actually that's pending in the Iowa legislature. The state health department has supported this bill and has helped draft it that would actually modernize the law a little bit. It would create sort of a tiered system so that the penalties would vary depending on whether transmission occurred, whether the person intended to infect the other person. It would go make the law a little bit more nuanced in those ways. State prosecutors have kind of been a little ambivalent, maybe even opposed the law. They find that it would be almost unenforceable if you had to prove that somebody intended to infect someone. But the state health department is very much behind it. Local advocacy groups have been very, very in support of it and have helped work on it. And then you have a couple of state legislators, including one who I think is like a former sheriff, who have sponsored the bill and are trying to make that, make its way through the legislature in Iowa.
Well, Sergio Hernandez is a freelance journalist for ProPublica. His article, Sex, Lies, and HIV, When What You Don't Tell Your Partner is a Crime, was published Sunday. It's a look at it. Case of an Iowa man who's charged with having sex without first disclosing he had HIV. It's going to be awaiting a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court whether they will take up that case. Sergio Hernandez, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're talking about HIV and AIDS this hour. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation to get a little reaction. John Chamberlain is a spokesperson for the Iowa HIV Anti-Stigma Campaign. And he has HIV and AIDS. John Chamberlain joins us from our studio in Des Moines. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being on to share your perspective. When you hear the case, and it's a case I know that you're familiar with, the case we were just speaking of, what are your thoughts on the law and how the law stands in Iowa?
Well, I think the law does exactly the opposite of what it's intended to do. And I believe it actually increases the risk of HIV in the community. One of the things that wasn't mentioned was that if you don't know your status, then you cannot be prosecuted, even if you do infect someone. So it discourages people from getting tested. It takes the responsibility away from each partner and assumes that all responsibility falls on the HIV-positive person.
You're saying a person would, because of the fact that if they don't know, then they can't be charged with intentionally transmitting something they don't technically know that they have.
Exactly.
Well, tell us a little bit about your story. You've had HIV and AIDS for a number of years. How did the testing process work for you? How did you come to know that you were infected?
Well, I was tested in, several times, but the last time when I received my positive diagnosis was 1996. There are only two ways you find out whether or not you have this disease. You get tested regularly, or you end up in the hospital very, very sick. And I believe Iowa is one of the highest states of late diagnoses. I believe I read someplace 47% perhaps. Don't know if they have it until they end up in the hospital close to death. I was tested because as a homosexual man, as a gay man who certainly had a promiscuous life, it fits the stereotype, although not all cases are like that. And I had also used drugs in the past. So as most of my friends were dying who had similar behaviors, it became apparent that as the new medicines came available, it was better to know and get on treatment earlier than later.
And how are you doing today?
Well, my viral load, which is the amount of virus in my blood, is undetectable. That means fewer than, I believe, 25, whatever they use to test it. And that means that I have a very low chance of ever giving this disease to anybody else. And that's where we're headed now with treatment, it seems like, is that if we can get enough people tested or get everyone tested, as the Department of Public Health suggests, and get them on medicines, then that's how this virus will be eliminated.
Can you talk a little bit about what you see as how the public perception of people that are HIV positive, how has that changed even in the time between your first positive test and today?
Well, I hadn't noticed. For me, I've been working in this area for almost 30 years, almost as long as it's been around. So I've been well-educated, and my friends were well-educated. And I've lived in larger cities. I left Iowa at 17 and returned about 6 years ago. And I hadn't really discovered much stigma or prejudice until I returned to Iowa, where we just simply don't want to talk about the dirtiness that people associate this disease with, because it includes blood products or needles or homosexuality. Iowa is pretty much a don't ask, don't tell state when it comes to things like that. And since I've been back here, I've been, oh my gosh, I've been beaten up. I've been hit. I've been spit on. Even the slightest thing of somebody backing away from you once you tell them are all new things to me. So it's clear that we need to be talking about this more and educating people more.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear those things happen to you. How do we go about doing what you say? How do we go about educating in the way that you're speaking about?
Well, I myself and a friend of mine, a dear friend, Lori Friest, have a speakers bureau, and we go to different prison facilities. We deal with at-risk youth. I would like if we could get into high schools or maybe even junior highs at a point when people are starting to discover their sexuality. But again, that varies from school to school and school boards. And I believe it's covered in public health, but slightly. We need to help everyone understand that this disease does not discriminate, that you can be 2 years old or you can be 90 years old. You can be male. You can be female. You can be straight. You can be gay. The Latino and black populations have higher incidences based on their percentage of populations. So it's just we have to keep educating.
Well, and the other change, of course, is that this disease has so many fewer headlines than maybe it did years back, and so less attention. Is it on the back burner? Has that affected the reaction and perceptions?
Well, yes, I would totally agree with that. People think that you just take a pill and you're going to be fine. Those pills that I take cause me to take four or five other pills that deal with the side effects that come along with these. My body is aging several times more quickly than someone who hasn't, who doesn't have this disease, just the mere fact of having this disease and my immune system having to work around the clock is putting years beyond my age. So things that would happen to someone in their 70s are occurring to me now at 51.
Well, John Chamberlain, stay with us. We're going to come back to you. We're going to be taking a short break in just a minute, but first I want to introduce one more of our guests, and that is Jeffrey Meyer, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and an Infectious Disease Specialist with the University of Iowa Healthcare HIV Program and Site Director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. Dr. Meyer, thank you for being in our studio here.
Good afternoon.
Well, again, like I mentioned, we'll be taking a short break, but quickly, before we do so, what do we know now about either transmission or prevention? Are there new things? Do we understand the process of transmission differently now than we may have years ago?
Well, I think over the years we've learned a lot about HIV and how it's transmitted and how to prevent it and knowing what the relative risk is per sex act and what sorts of sex acts are more likely to transmit than others. We recognize now that treatment is prevention, that treatment of HIV in a person who's infected suppresses the virus, gets the virus down to a very low level in your body, and that itself prevents transmission to others. So there, I think we've come a long way in our understanding of prevention and preventing transmission. We've also come a long way in treatment and developing new medications that are better tolerated. And I would say that with people who come into care early with a early in the diagnosis, John talked about less late diagnoses, late testers. Those persons who come into diagnosis late are more likely to have complications, and they're more likely to have problems perhaps with their medications, as opposed to people who come in with a new diagnosis very early on in the course of their HIV infection. They get on treatment, and there's a good chance they could have a near normal or normal life expectancy.
And when we talk about these late identifications of the disease, how long has somebody had HIV and then get tested to be called somebody who is a late tester?
Well, it varies from person to person just how long it takes to, you know, from the time of infection to develop dramatic changes in your immune system, to develop what we call immunodeficiency. And it's when you become immunodeficient is when you become vulnerable to unusual infections, common infections, unusual cancers, and so forth. That can vary from person to person, but it could be years.
Thank you, Jeffrey Meyer. Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be taking a short break. Jeffrey Meyer, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist at the University of Iowa Healthcare HIV Program. Also with us, John Chamberlain, spokesperson for the Iowa HIV Anti-Stigma Campaign. We'll be back talking about what the Public Health Department has in store for Iowans and what their efforts are. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. So glad you're with us on River to River. I'm Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer. We're talking about an update to HIV and AIDS. What are the prevention measures, treatment? We spoke in the first half a bit about Iowa's transmission law. And still with us in this half of the program, Jeffrey Meyer, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and an Infectious Disease Specialist with the University of Iowa Healthcare HIV Program. He's also the Site Director of Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. John Chamberlain is spokesperson for the Iowa HIV Anti-Stigma Campaign and has HIV and AIDS. In a moment, we'll be talking with representatives from Iowa's Department of Public Health. But before we took the break on the program, Dr. Meyer, I know there's a few more thoughts that you had sort of relating to the transmission law, and then we'll be moving on to other topics. But quickly, didn't get fully get your reaction to, has the law in Iowa, the HIV transmission law, has it affected the way you do your job?
Yes. Thank you for asking that question, Ben. Yeah, I think that it has. Our focus is on treatment. You know, I'm a physician and working in a clinic, and so I'm seeing people with HIV positive, who are HIV positive, and one of our objectives is to get their HIV viral load under control, to get their HIV virus under control. And we know now that treatment is prevention, so that if we get their virus under control, they're a lot less likely to be infectious and transmit the virus to others. In fact, you know, the risk of potentially transmitting to others through sex, such as intercourse, you know, vaginal penile intercourse or penile anal intercourse, is much less likely. The transmission will occur once you have the person's HIV viral load under control, and that risk is very, very low, almost near zero. So I think that is important for us from a public health standpoint to work toward that objective. One of the problems with the current law is, as John pointed out, is that if you know you don't know your status, you don't know your HIV, and you're out having a relationship, a sexual relationship with somebody, and you go ahead and have sex, then you're not held to the law because you don't know you're positive. So therefore, if you don't disclose, it's not you're not breaking the law. So there's a tendency for people who know they're at risk for HIV infection not to get tested because they don't want to know. Okay, so that's actually a deterrent to testing. And my role is to get people into care as quickly as possible, test them, make sure we find the people out there who are positive so they're not a public health hazard to others, to get them into care early so we can keep them healthy. Because as I mentioned before, that if we get them on treatment early, we detect HIV early in the course of the infection, that we can they can end up with what I would consider a near normal life expectancy.
Okay. Thank you, Jeffrey Meyer. Well, as we mentioned earlier, December 1st was World AIDS Day. And on Monday in Washington, D.C., President Obama spoke about World AIDS Day. He said that he'll be continuing to work to, in his words, turn the tide of the epidemic. And that would include, as he said, keeping up support for the Global Fund, which supports efforts to combat AIDS and other illnesses.
You know, its success speaks for itself. It's helping over 6 million people in over 140 countries receive antiretroviral therapy. And now it's time to replenish the fund. The United States will contribute $1 for every $2 pledged by other donors over the next 3 years, up to $5 billion total from the United States. And the United Kingdom has made a similar promise. So today I want to urge all those who are attending the Global Fund's replenishment meetings, both today and tomorrow, to take up this commitment. Don't leave our money on the table. It's been inspiring to see the countries most affected by this disease vastly increase their own contributions to this fight, in some cases providing more than donor countries do.
Again, President Obama pledging $5 billion from the United States to the Global Fund to help combat AIDS across the globe. Now I want to introduce two more guests from the Iowa Department of Public Health's Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis. Patricia Young is HIV Prevention Program Manager. Patricia, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us, Ben.
I'm glad to have you on. And Jerry Harms is HIV Surveillance Coordinator. Thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for inviting us, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm not sure how the Global Fund might affect how you do your job here in Iowa, but can you talk briefly about how the funding for your programs does come to you?
Both of our programs are funded, receive funding from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta.
Okay, very good. And one of the things that you're hoping to do, why don't you describe what you want Iowans to do exactly?
Sure. as Dr. Meyer and John talked about, I think it's important that everybody at least get one documented HIV test. And then persons who have risk factors, then we recommend that they would have a test yearly, because the sooner there's been compelling evidence that, you know, once somebody's on antiretroviral medications, they really enhance the quality and longevity of their life and reduce HIV transmission.
And who is most at risk?
In Iowa, the majority of diagnoses are men who have sex with men.
Yeah. Actually, probably over 60% of new Iowa diagnoses are in men who have sex with men. And when you take a look a little bit more inside that data, you will find that roughly three-quarters of men who are diagnosed with HIV have contracted the disease in that way.
And just a few moments, we'll open up the phone lines. If you have a question about treatment, prevention, or perhaps some of the public perception of HIV and AIDS, join our conversation. How has that changed over years? You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can also send email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And now, Patricia, Jerry Harms, I go to you with more about the numbers. There are possibly hundreds of Iowans that don't know that they're infected. How do we know that?
Well, let's start at the beginning. HIV data are not static. They're dynamic. They're ever-changing. And in Iowa, we've been averaging around 120 new diagnoses every year, but that's only a part of it. We have at least that many more folks that move into Iowa that have been diagnosed elsewhere. So we're talking, in the neighborhood of 240 to 250 people that might be new either through a new diagnosis or a previous diagnosis and moved into the state. And then if we take into consideration that we have maybe 25 to 30 persons, HIV-infected persons that pass away each year, and also tracking that we will have some folks move out. At our most recent numbers were that we had about 2,300 persons that were living with an HIV diagnosis in the state. But when we take into account that we may have around 1% underreporting of HIV, and then CDC has estimated that around 18% of people are undiagnosed, and when we back calculate on that, we may have as many as 2,800 folks living in the state that have HIV. So there are roughly somewhere between 500 and 600 that we don't know about.
How do people get tested?
We have through their physicians, going into their physician's office to get tested. We do have some test sites located throughout the state where people can go in and get tested also.
And what's involved with testing?
Primarily talking to a counselor, a physician, about the importance of getting tested, asking them questions, actually there's many different forms of testing available, and so that you would have to, a person would have to talk to their physician. Is it a blood draw? Sometimes we have what we call rapid testing, where somebody can know in a very short period of time if they have the antibodies to the virus present. And the other thing is with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, that it will include HIV testing as a preventive service, that there'll be no copay for the patient beginning in January of 2014.
So people will have that included as part of their health insurance program.
Exactly.
Coverage. I want to talk a little bit about this, going back to this idea of treatment as prevention, as we heard Dr. Meyer briefly talk about it. Is that something that the Department of Public Health connects with?
Exactly. I think that the sooner people get tested and get on treatment, that the amount of virus in the blood will be decreased and really will enhance that person's quality and longevity of life, but also reduce HIV transmission to others.
And how do we go about your office is explain more about the process that you have to get, I guess, get the word out or to get more people. What's the challenge? What's preventing people from getting tested? And is it realistic? Maybe that's another question. Is it realistic to think every Iowan will do it?
I think we have to continue to get the word out, talk to physicians, as John talked about, talking in schools, just at public meetings, talking about the importance of getting tested. And, I mean, not being afraid to bring up the conversation with family, friends, loved ones, et cetera.
And let's go back to you, John Chamberlain. What do you see as the challenges of preventing people that might otherwise we talked a little bit about this law earlier, but other challenges to preventing people from getting tested?
I think there are many challenges. For one, it's if you decide to get the test and you test positive, your whole life changes. You're almost guaranteed to have depression and anxiety. So there's a fear of not wanting to accept that news. In our rural communities, it's maybe difficult to talk to your local physician or to have a testing site nearby. So the transportation can be another issue. There are many things. Straight heterosexual folks don't tend to think that they're at any risk for it, that it's just a gay disease. Many barriers.
And Dr. Jeffrey Meyer, what's your perspective on treatment, not treatment, but testing?
Well, I think there are many barriers to testing. we have risk groups that, as Pat and Jerry had pointed out, gay and bisexual men who are certainly at higher risk for HIV, and we need to. So the question is, what are the barriers from getting those folks into being tested on a regular basis? And I think the law is one barrier. As John pointed out, there are other barriers. The stigma. Stigma is a huge problem in Iowa. And, I'm an Iowan. I was born in Iowa. I moved away, came back. And I'm shocked at the level of stigma that we still have in Iowa 20 years later. I've been providing HIV care since 1987, and I would like to see that stigma to go down. But I think there's a lot to be done in this area, is try to reduce stigma in Iowa.
Why do you think that stigma is there?
I think there's still a fair amount of misconception about HIV in the public arena. I don't know. I think if you go and you look at some of the national surveys that have been done by other organizations and looking at the public's knowledge about how HIV is transmitted and what is the importance of HIV on the radar? I'm startled I'm shocked actually of just how much we've really gained in knowledge from a public standpoint in terms of how HIV is transmitted and so forth. And looking even at the CDC data about our own schools in Iowa, looking at secondary schools and high schools and how much education is being provided in there. It's not I can't say that's 100%.
It's improved. It's not completely gone away, the stigma. But talk what those misperceptions you talked about, what are they specifically?
There's in schools In a number of schools across the nation, including Iowa, there's not conversation about stigma. There's not conversation, it centers around HIV. There's a lot of stigma, obviously, associated with other sexually transmitted infections. HIV, is just one of them. But HIV always tends to be a lot more important when it comes to stigma than for, let's say, chlamydia or gonorrhea. The other thing is just exactly, about HIV. How do you get it? You know, what do you, you know, how, you know, is it treatable? How do you prevent it? And so I think, you know, we need to do a better job, I think, getting the message out just about exactly how HIV is transmitted. I have a lot of anecdotes recently, okay, within the past year. I would love to be able to share those, but, you know, we don't have the time to talk about it, but I've encountered so many situations where stigma has really been a problem, discrimination has been a problem in Iowa because of somebody's HIV status.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit here and return to Patricia Young. Jerry Harms might be able to address an idea that here in Iowa there's fewer cases than maybe a large city, Chicago perhaps. But can you talk about the transmitting resistance to drugs? Can we talk about that a little bit? Do we know what types of, I don't know if I call them strains of the virus that are resistant to those drugs? Do we have information about what's happening in Iowa?
We do not have a lot of information about what's happening in Iowa. Our funds to conduct surveillance on that level are very limited. In fact, our surveillance funding has been cut substantially over the last couple of years, and we're not able to do what large cities do that are funded to collect information on what we would call genotyping, which will chronicle the resistance to the various drugs, and it may be that Dr. Meyer can add some information to this just in terms of resistance testing.
Sure. So I think that we see drug resistance here in Iowa, and this is something that I had a special interest in over the past few years, taking a look at drug resistance and people come in with a new diagnosis of HIV. They've never been on treatment before. And I've worked with a medical student and a PhD student in the College of Public Health here at the University of Iowa, and we've taken a look at that. And we've looked at this over several years now, and we're finding about 12 to 15% of people who come in for the first time with a new HIV diagnosis have resistance to one of our first-line HIV drugs. And so if you say, well, how does that compare to other places in the nation, like the big cities, Chicago, you know, other large areas where we have high endemicity of HIV, you would say that it's pretty much comparable. It's really unchanged. So just because we're in Iowa or in a rural state, we have a low prevalence of HIV, doesn't mean we're protected from these other factors, such as, you know, carrying a virus which is resistant to some of our medications.
Those people that are tested and then get a positive result, do we know if they're immediately seeking a physician's help? What do we know about that?
We do know that a very high percentage, around 80, almost 90% over the last few years, have been seeking a physician's help within the first 3 months of their diagnosis. It's something that we track and that CDC requires tracking. So a very high percentage do that. The percentage falls off in terms of how many of them remain in care, however, and it may be that 60 to 70% of them may stay in care, whereas the others, as far as we can tell, do not maintain care. It may be that some actually, and we do know that some move out of state and continue care elsewhere.
But those that don't, why would they stop care? Do we know?
We really don't have a good handle on it. It may be, one may be just paying for the medications, although medications are available through the AIDS Drug Assistance Program in the state of Iowa through the Ryan White Program. And we really don't know, and that's one of the goals that we would like to accomplish as we move forward, is to try to get people reengaged in care. And as part of that, we would want to ask some questions about why they dropped care in the first place. So it's an unanswered question to a great degree.
Well, just briefly, we're going to run out of time in just a minute. I wanted to just briefly touch on some other related news. Patricia Young and Jerry Harms, your department at the Iowa Department of Public Health, it's the Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis, and there's some news about hepatitis C this morning, new treatment for hepatitis C. How is hepatitis related to HIV? Is it?
Well, this is John. About a third of us have co-infections with HIV and hepatitis C.
That's right. And Dr. Meyer, what's the relationship?
Well, there's the same route of transmission, through blood products, sharing needles. You can transmit hepatitis C through sex, although it's inefficient, but it happens.
Very good. Well, we're out of time for the program, but Dr. Jeffrey Meyer, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist with the University of Iowa Healthcare HIV Program and Site Director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. Thank you for coming in today. We appreciate that. And Patricia Young is HIV Prevention Program Manager at the Iowa Department of Public Health's Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Jerry Harms, HIV Surveillance Coordinator in the same department. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
John Chamberlain, thank you for joining us, spokesperson for the Iowa HIV Anti-Stigma Campaign and a man living with HIV and AIDS. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you, Ben.
I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer, River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.